It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a record number of brick-and-mortar stores closed this year across the country, including Wisconsin's own Book World and Bon-Ton. But consumer confidence is at a 17-year high. We'll break down what these trends might mean for the economy and the future of retail. First, when Republican lawmakers passed their tax overhaul bill this month, they included a repeal of the individual mandate in the Affordable Care Act, commonly known as Obamacare. The mandate has been controversial in some circles, but supporters say that the individual mandate brought costs down and worry that its repeal could dismantle the Health Care Act as a whole. But those fears might be unfounded. New analysis shows the repeal of the individual mandate might not be the ACA death blow many people feared. Philip Rocco is an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. He's also the author of the book Obamacare Wars. Phil, welcome back to Central Time.
Great to be here, Judith. Thanks.
So just briefly, Phil, can you refresh our listeners on what the individual mandate was and why it was seen as controversial?
Sure. So the individual mandate was a part of the ACA that said that if you didn't have insurance from your employer or you didn't have it in some other way, you had to purchase insurance on a marketplace created by the ACA. And then if you didn't, you would have a penalty, something around $695 for every uninsured adult that doesn't buy insurance. And the reason that existed was that in the past, when state governments had tried to expand access to insurance through sort of expanding access to the individual market, what they found was that the people who tended to sign up were the people who really needed health care now, people who were sick. Healthy people didn't sign up. And this led premiums to explode, and insurance markets weren't stable. And so what the individual mandate was supposed to do was to bring premiums on insurance down by balancing out that risk pool, providing some incentive, right, the idea that you'd have to pay a penalty. And the idea was to bring young and healthy people into the market.
I'm guessing that that penalty, if you did not buy insurance, was still quite a bit less expensive than if people were buying into the marketplace. So was that actually enough to create that kind of buffer?
Yeah, this is one of the major, the funny thing is the politics of the individual mandate were sort of toxic. It was the least popular provision of the entire ACA. It was kind of one of the things that initially sparked a Supreme Court battle over the ACA. So it's not really popular. The irony of that is it probably was not hefty enough to induce people to buy insurance. It was especially when compared to how some people might think about how expensive premiums are in some markets, that penalty might have not seemed like that much money. And so a recent study in the Journal of Health Economics that's come out has suggested that, you know, when you look at why people got coverage, that the real thing that explains why people got coverage is, you know, either they found out they were newly eligible for subsidies under the ACA and that those subsidies were generous, or they were eligible for some other part of the ACA, like the Medicaid expansion. But this study seems to suggest that the size of the penalty really didn't matter as much, that there wasn't a sort of compliance effect, that people were worried that they were going to get punished if they didn't pay the penalty.
So GOP lawmakers tried a few times this year to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act without success, but then they were able to roll this repeal of the individual mandate into the tax bill. Was that a surprise to anyone?
No, I think that the thing that made the attempts to repeal and replace the ACA so toxic earlier in the year was that Republicans, you know, naturally included provisions in those repeal plans that seemed to create opportunities to take away things like protections for people with pre-existing conditions and subsidies to purchase insurance. and repealed the individual mandate as well, but also took away a lot of the popular parts of the ACA that people liked. And so it's not surprising to me that, you know, in this sort of omnibus do-or-die moment for Republicans, that they would include a kind of, a way of fulfilling their promise to repeal some major part of the ACA in that law.
So the individual mandate was touted by a lot of supporters of Obamacare as really a linchpin part of it. We just saw a shortened enrollment period for the ACA, but it seems like numbers were good. How would you assess the recent enrollment period that just ended a couple weeks ago?
I mean, I think that one thing that seems to be clear is that over the last year, the threat of the ACA potentially going away has had a kind of maybe the reverse effect of what Republicans might have intended. The threat of the ACA going away, I think, has in part led more people to learn about what benefits they're in fact eligible for. Right? Are you eligible for premium tax credits to help you purchase health insurance? Are you eligible for Medicaid? And so, it's not surprising to me that people have that the threat of that has not, in fact, led people to stop enrolling, but enrollment has sort of continued apace. I wouldn't suggest that enrollment has somehow like gotten better as a result of kind of repeal being on the table. But I think that as people find out about the benefits that they're eligible for, and the ACA, I think initially didn't necessarily do as good a job as it could have about telling people, what are the benefits that you can get, once people learn about them, they might be more likely to sign up.
Phil Rocco is an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University, and he's the author of the book Obamacare Wars. We're talking about the repeal of the individual mandate that is part of the new tax plan. And what are we hearing, Phil, from the health care or the health insurance industries with the repeal of the individual mandate?
Well, I think that there's sort of been mixed signals from what I've observed. I think there are some insurers, at least I read in the Journal Sentinel today, that there are some insurers who are suggesting that the repeal of the individual mandate won't have much of an effect on premiums, that the marketplaces are going to look somewhat like they've looked in the past. Now, the usual source of information for this kind of question is the Congressional Budget Office. And the Congressional Budget Office tries to forecast what the effects of policy changes on the ACA are going to be. And in the past, the CBO had projected that repealing the individual mandate would, by 2027, lead to 13 million fewer people with insurance. But recently, the CBO has begun to sort of reevaluate whether or not its forecasts were including some of the right variables, and so there's some uncertainty about whether or not that many people would lose insurance, whether or not premiums would go up as much as they had anticipated. But I would note that I think we don't have a very clear sense of just how many people would opt not to sign up for the ACA if individual mandate didn't exist, right? We know that the individual mandate hasn't been especially effective at getting people to sign up, that people signed up for many other reasons. But if you take it away, right, it might still be the case that people don't sign up, and that in some marketplaces, this makes the risk pool a lot sicker, a lot worse off, and insurers raise premiums. The American Academy of Actuaries, which is a big professional association who study these kinds of things, have still suggested that eliminating the individual mandate would lead to premium increases. But the point is, I think that we're in a condition where we don't really know how bad it would be.
So, Phil, as we start to wrap up, it seems like the stick in the form of the penalty for not signing up for insurance has not been particularly effective. That seems to indicate that maybe it's time to look for some really juicy carrots that will encourage people. Knowing what we know about the American healthcare consumers, what do you think would entice them to opt for healthcare coverage?
Well, I think that looking at the people that we want to bring into the marketplace, young, healthy people into the marketplace, you know, we need to look at the kinds of benefits that those people want when they're signing up for health insurance coverage, right? Whether or not that's sort of generous subsidies, depending on the area that they're living in, but also benefits that, you know, advantage them for living a healthy lifestyle and things like that. But there might be benefit packages that we haven't necessarily thought about as enticing to those people. But I do think that the really important thing to keep in mind here is that the generosity of the benefits that people experience as a result of getting the ACA is something that really matters for whether or not people sign up.
Well, Phil, thanks so much for spending time with us today.
Great to be here.
Philip Rocco is an assistant professor of political science at Marquette University. He's also the author of the book Obamacare Wars. He joined us to talk about the repeal of the ACA's individual mandate via the tax bill and why it might have less of an impact on the healthcare law than previously expected. Coming up, consumer confidence is high, but the fate of brick-and-mortar stores is uncertain. We'll take a look at what these trends and factors might mean for the economy. Stay with us here on Central Time. Right now, retail giants Kmart, JCPenney, and Gap closed thousands of stores this year, which can sometimes point to a rough economy. But consumer confidence is booming. People are still spending, and they're more confident about the economy than they've been in 17 years. Dee Warmath is an assistant professor of consumer science at the University of Wisconsin's Wisconsin-Madison School of Human Ecology. Dee, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So you'd think that with consumer confidence at an all-time high, stores would be doing pretty well. But CNN says over 6,000 brick-and-mortar stores closed this year, more than any year on record. So why is that happening now?
Well, I think there are a lot of reasons, and there are a lot of global reasons, and there are a lot of specific retailer, individual retailer reasons. Personally, I don't think it's a problem. That number of stores is less than 1% of total retail establishments in the U.S. So even though it's high, it probably isn't enough. So if you think about the fact that in America, we have a little over 20 square feet of retail space for every man, woman, and child. And in Europe, that's about 2.5 feet for mm-hmm. every person. Mm-hmm. So we are definitely an overstored economy, and that is getting much worse given the fact that stores are no longer the point of purchase. They're just one stop along the destination to a purchase. And so I think that this is not necessarily a bad thing. No, people have been calling it the retail apocalypse, which I think is probably a little overstated for what's really happening.
So it sounds like you're saying that this is more of maybe a correction in the retail consumer industry than an apocalypse, like you're saying it's sometimes being called.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what it is an evolution. I think that, you know, now that we have e-commerce and m-commerce and every other form of commerce that's possible, you don't necessarily have to go into a store to make a purchase. It used to be that if you didn't have a store in every one of those towns, that people couldn't come to you, they couldn't buy from you. That's no longer the case. So I think that what we're seeing is retailers really having to rethink why they have stores, what's the role of those stores, and then therefore, where should those stores be to deliver what needs to be delivered in the emerging retail marketplace? So stores are kind of a thing of the past, even though the majority of retail sales still occur through them. And by stores in that sense, I mean stores that are treated like glorified warehouses mm-hmm. to hold a lot of product for people to go and to pick up. Now you can have that product in an actual warehouse down the street and have it delivered to your house. So stores have to rethink what it is that they do and why they exist.
So if I'm understanding this, maybe some of those stores that we're hearing, or those chains that are closing, you know, dozens of stores, brick and mortar stores, maybe they're not actually hurting so much in what they're selling because they're selling in different ways.
That's true. And I think if you look at some of the numbers, I've read some reports that say that retail employment is actually up. Even though stores are being closed. So thinking about how those retail employees are being redeployed or you know, winning retailers and what they're using these new hirings for in that way, like that would be a very interesting thing to go and explore more deeply. So it's not necessarily that that it's a bad thing for retail sales that stores are closing. It could be a good thing. Now, there are some chains that are closing entirely and some that are expected to close. And I think that that's very sad because obviously that's a lot of loss for the people who work for those retail mm-hmm. organizations. And there are people who just sort of ran out of time, right? Because they couldn't figure out how to evolve for the current retail marketplace in time to sort of save themselves and save the jobs of the people who work for them. When you look at others who have 1,000 stores and they're choosing to close 100 of those stores, to me, that feels like prudent business. So I think that we have to look at each of these on a case-by-case basis and what were the things that they couldn't do that didn't allow them to evolve into the new marketplace.
We're talking with Dee Wormath. She's an assistant professor of consumer science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison's School of Human Ecology, and we're looking at the fate of brick-and-mortar stores and how that does or doesn't correlate with consumer confidence and consumer activity. And Dee, so in this new type of economy that you're describing, what thrives and what doesn't? What gets consumers feeling good and spending money?
Well, lately, one of the things that has gotten consumers to spend money are deep discounts, right? If you want me to play the game and you're willing to give me enough of an incentive, you're willing to pay me to come into your store, I'll come in. That doesn't seem sustainable. So the things that I think are really going to thrive going forward are the retail establishments that understand the consumer and the consumer needs. And we talk about evolving to the future of retail, but in some ways it's sort of like going backward in time, because that's what happened in those early original retail stores back in the late 1800s, early 1900s. They had to know their consumers. They had to convince them and stock the product they needed and provide the experience when they came in the door that they expected to keep them coming back. So I think that if we can get away from this sort of mass herd mentality of get people in the store and get them to make a purchase while they're there and buy other things they didn't intend while they're there, and start to really go back to what does a consumer want? What does a consumer need? What are their aspirations for experience? What are their aspirations for a relationship? And how can I find a meaningful connection with the consumer? That's how you're going to get consumers into your doors.
So that's really interesting to me because, you know, not that long ago, 20, maybe 30 years ago, the huge concern and fear was that the big retailers were driving out the mom and pop businesses. And, you know, we were losing all these small, very personality driven and personalized businesses in favor of these big boxes that, you know, it's the same whether you walk into it in, you know, Green Bay, Wisconsin, or Tulsa, Oklahoma, or somewhere in California. And now it sounds like you're saying that maybe the trend to get ahead of the trend is to go back more towards those values of those independent retailers.
Absolutely. I mean, I do think that they had it right. At least in that relationship experience side of things. They didn't necessarily have the purchasing power that the large big box retailers had. They couldn't offer the prices and the discounts. They couldn't make sure that you could find what you needed no matter where you were. And they didn't have as much resources to invest in some of the new channels for retail sales. So I think that that was a challenge. But certainly going back to the authenticity of their story, the connection they had with the community, you know, those are things that that retailers, the larger retailers today, are trying to figure out because they know that's important to their future.
So it does seem, obviously, that a much larger portion of online shopping is taking a big chunk out of shopping in general. But still, I think I saw a statistic recently that it's still only about 17 or 19% of all consumer shopping is online, whereas it feels like it's so much. Who is doing that online shopping, and is that likely to continue to grow?
And I think a lot of people are doing that online shopping. Some people do only online shopping and other people dabble. And I think that it's going to continue to grow. And I think ultimately we're going to become very channel agnostic, right? It's going to be about retail sales and not necessarily specifically where they occurred. But over this holiday season, retail sales grew, I think it was 20% compared to 4.9% for total retail. So it's certainly growing faster and faster. And there are a lot of different reasons why people do that. Sometimes it's time. Sometimes it's I need something unusual or an unusual size and they don't have it in store. So I think there are a lot of reasons why people are turning to e-commerce more and more. And I also think another factor is that retailers are figuring out how to do certain categories. I teach a retail channel strategy course here at Madison, and I used to talk 5-6 years ago about the fact that home improvement was a category that no one had really figured out in the e-commerce space. And now you have Wayfair.
Right.
And, you know, and so they've figured it out. So I think that as people find ways to overcome barriers to shopping for particular categories online, more and more people are going to be willing to go online to do their shopping.
Briefly, as we start getting towards the end of the interview, how does loyalty fit in? Because I think it used to be there was a lot of loyalty to the store on your corner or to the airline that you bought your tickets from because you went into a travel agent and asked for a ticket on Pan Am. We'll use one that's not even around anymore. And now with aggregator sites and stuff, you're going in there and you're looking at the cheapest one. And for the most part, it's like, I don't care what airline it is. If it's $30 cheaper and it's direct, I'm going to take it. Are we losing some of that loyalty in general in the consumer realm?
Well, I think that that you'd have to question whether loyalty really existed or not. I mean, 80% of the people that belong to retailers A's loyalty program also belong to retailer B's loyalty program. So in some ways, there probably wasn't. But I think that that it's incumbent on the retailer to be able to find connections so that the consumer then decides to put their eggs in that basket to build relationships with that particular airline or retail store.
Well, Dee, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Dee Wormath is an assistant professor of consumer science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Human Ecology. She joined us to talk about the changing fate of brick and mortar stores. Stay with us here on Central Time. First, as 2017 comes to a close, we wanted to take time to look back at some of the best books of the year. Whether you're a fan of fiction, memoirs, history, or other genres, every category had some standouts this year. And we want to hear what you think. You can share some of your favorite books of 2017 by calling 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Joining us now to talk about some of the best books of 2017 is Mark Rotella. He's a senior editor at Publishers Weekly, where he also hosts their PW radio show. He's also an author and a board member of the National Book Critics Circle. Mark, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. It's great to talk about books, especially in between holidays.
I agree. I've been looking forward to this segment all week. So, Mark, how would you characterize 2017 in a literary sense?
So, you know, we've got a lot of, well, we've got, I'm going to talk about fiction and nonfiction. In nonfiction, we have books on immigration. We have books about maybe fake news coming in not so much the, in throughout history and now. And then we talk about, we have a lot of extreme words like extreme and fear in titles. In dealing with cities, so that's what we have there. When we talk about fiction, we have a lot of books by, or at least maybe several books by people who have writers who've gotten awards before, Hari Kunzru and Jasmine Ward, quite a few others. So that's what we've got right now. What would you like to talk about?
Well, let's start with fiction. And one of your favorite fiction picks this year was Pachinko by Min Jin Lee. Tell us about that novel.
So First of all, Minjin is happens to be a friend of mine, but I've been following her writing as well. This one takes place pre-World War II Korea, and this is, you know, we talked about immigration just a little bit ago, but this one takes place in Korea, or I'm sorry, in Japan by Korean immigrants moving there, and it follows the path of two brothers as they're trying to make their lives as immigrants in Japan. And it's a grand epic novel, and it's just really delightful, beautifully written. And that was one of my favorite books this year.
And that Pachinko ended up on a lot of best of 2017 lists this year. Why do you think it had such broad appeal to so many critics?
I think because of the immigration point of it, and about with families, and not just families, it adds in another twist to the family dynamic. And when you put it, it always says when there's books about war, it puts a lot of pressure on characters. And this is one really in between war. The war is in the background. World War II is in the background. But the pressure is that of immigration and trying for a family trying to stay together and succeed in tough times.
And I'm going to throw in here my favorite fiction book of
Please
the year.
Do.
Because it really, you know, I love to read, and I love to read a really wide and I'll say eclectic bunch of books, but this one has really stayed with me. It's called Eleanor Oliphant is Completely Fine, and it's by Gail Honeyman, and it's her debut novel. And I just have to say this book, I just felt so protective of the main character, Eleanor, and also other characters. You follow Eleanor through her daily life and in her thoughts, and you know that she's gone through something really horrendous, but the exposition is neither too abrupt or too plodding. And along the way, you see how both rewarding and challenging basic human interactions can be for someone who didn't grow up observing them. And I don't want to give away too much, but you really come to appreciate how fully fleshed out and complex this character is. And as are the people around her. And it's, you also have the sense that it's a fact that's lost on Eleanor herself until she can get past some of her own obstacles to see how much of a real complete human being she is. It really touched me in ways that I just didn't expect it to.
Well, in this book also, if I'm not mistaken, I know it takes place in Glasgow, but it's also about her life as a finance clerk and,
yes,
and someone who she meets in the office. And so many of us who work in offices, you were saying that this is, you know, there's, you could feel the pain that she experiences and kind of the heartache.
Yes, yes. And you do, I think one of the things that I enjoyed the most is that you also realize that even though Eleanor isn't able to necessarily sense the goodwill around her, there is actually a lot of goodwill around her. Even if people aren't quite sure how to relate to her, they're actually around her hoping to help her and reach her even when she's not aware of it. And that just kind of restored some, you know, faith in humanity for me as well.
Yeah, exactly. It's that faith in humanity that I'm also finding in so many of these books. Or at least, if not the faith in humanity, maybe questioning humanity in some cases.
We're talking with Mark Rotella right now. He is a senior editor at Publishers Weekly. We are talking about the best books of 2017 and would love to have you join in with your picks at 800-642-1234. And Mark, you read a lot of books, obviously, but your specialty really is in nonfiction. And you've included a number of biographies in your list. Tell us about The Queen of Bebop, The Musical Lives of Sarah Vaughan by Elaine Hayes. And I want to say it says musical lives of, and I'm curious about that.
So Sarah Vaughan, who grew up in Newark, this Elaine Hayes is a jazz biographer, a jazz writer, and Sarah Vaughan had many incarnations of music in her lives, and she's one who, at a time when women were not in control of their own career, I mean musicians in general, but especially an African-American woman with many producers trying to direct her career, she maintained steadfast in what she wanted to do. I mean, she had many lovers and boyfriends, and I believe a couple of husbands, but it was throughout how her music changed throughout decades and many decades long career. And what I think Elaine does really nicely is kind of bring to life what it was, you know, Newark in the 1920s and 30s, the whole, you know, growing up a, you know, singer in the church, and how that kind of formed her early musical career. And then how later on, even throughout the 70s and 80s, how her music was still vital.
Who do you think would appreciate reading this biography of Sarah Vaughan?
You know, I think people interested in, I do want to say African-American history. I think history of jazz. And I think someone who just wants to read about a strong woman who, you know, did what she had to do and for her own career.
And sticking with biographies, you've included an in-depth look at the life and legacy of Mikhail Gorbachev, the last leader of the Soviet Union, aptly titled Gorbachev, by William Taubman. What was it that made you want to include that biography in your best list?
Well, I was a Russian literature major in college, and I worked at the Harriman Institute at Columbia University, which was an institute for, at the time, was studying the Soviet Union. And during that time, Gorbachev came into power, the wall came down. And it, to me, I always found Gorbachev fascinating. And William Taubman is just a wonderful writer of history and biographer. And this is just one. He really brought Gorbachev to life, but also in context with the, you know, coming out of the Cold War in light of the Soviet Union and in Russia, modern day Russia. And I thought it was just a really solid, big book. It's like just a classic biography. Mm-hmm.
And I'll let you in on a secret, Mark. I have a master's in Russian history. So.
Oh, nice.
So that one jumped out at me. Also, sticking with Russia, you also included Masha Gessen's The Future is History, How Totalitarianism Reclaimed Russia. And do you think there's increased interest in Russia given investigations into whether Russia meddled in elections and whatnot?
I definitely think so, and I definitely think in this book especially because of that. But it's also looking at totalitarianism and autocracy, which is, you know, many people here in the U.S. are you know, reading about and questioning. Also, it had to do with obviously 1917. This past year was the centennial of the Russian Revolution. So there are quite a few books on the Russian Revolution coming up. And this one kind of takes off from those who were born just after the Cold War and how they thought that the new Russian state was going to follows seven characters and how the new Russian state was going to help them and change their lives. And by the end, not all of them, really very few of them, felt that it benefited their lives.
We're talking right now with Mark Rotella. He's senior editor at Publishers Weekly, and we are talking about the best books of 2017, and we would love to hear what made your list. You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What authors stood out to you in 2017? What books are still on your reading list? You might not have gotten to them in 2017, but you're going to carry them over to read in 2018. Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send us an email at ideas@wpr.org. And we'll pick up this conversation in just a moment. Stay with us here on Central Time. Right now, we're continuing our conversation about the best books of 2017 with Mark Rotella. He's a senior editor at Publishers Weekly. And you can join the conversation by calling 800-642-1234. What books really stood out to you this year? What were the books that you recommended to anyone who would listen? Were you drawn to any new genres, genres you don't usually pick up? And were there any particular authors that really piqued your interest in 2017? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. 1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Mark, Jeff from Dubuque, Iowa, called to say he couldn't put down John Feinstein's book, The First Major, The Inside Story of the 2016 Ryder Cup. And sports books, is that something that's a popular genre today?
It is. And that one, in particular, you know, so John Feinstein always seems to hit the nail right on the head. I mean, he comes out with books that focus on a specific era in the sport. And golf books are popular, obviously, in season. And it was really great to hear about that, your caller liked that book as well. But sports, baseball is always popular. I mean, they always do pretty well, especially in season. And golf, people love to read about golf.
I was really hoping you were going to say hit a hole in one instead of hit the nail on the head, but
I was going to.
Well, Ellery on Facebook loves to cook and loved two cookbooks this year. One is called Cook Japanese at Home, and the other is Tasting Georgia. And Ellery made the note, Georgia the country, not the state. And so those, the two very different parts of the world. You know, I actually know a lot of people who love to read cookbooks, like really read them. What makes a good reading cookbook?
So I think there's a sense of escape and being transported somewhere else, almost like a travel book. And here you have all kinds of sensories being piqued, you know, your taste sensories. And a really good cookbook author can especially someplace like the Georgia Cookbook, and that's becoming, that area of the world is becoming popular with foodies and with people who want to know a little bit more about it, and so there's a way of telling, mixing personal story with history, so you get a personal, you know, a first person sense of what it's like to be there, how the food tastes, but also in the context of the evolution of the country, the changing of the country. So I think that's what does it. And I think in general, I think it said people actually cook 3 to 5 recipes from any one cookbook, and then they'll go someplace else.
That sounds about right.
And it's just really about, you know, fantasizing about what the next meal is or not. I know people who read cookbooks who keep them by their bedside table.
Yes, I do too. And and I have to say, a cookbook that I really enjoyed reading recently, and we had the fortune to interview him on the show, or them on the show, was A Grandfather's Lessons in the Kitchen with Shorey by Jacques Pepin. And we talked with Jacques and his granddaughter Shorey, and it's a charming book, and it was charming to get the sense of their relationship and how cooking has really been so fundamental to that family relationship, and you know, just a joy to read.
Well, and I find Jacques Pepin and his books to be really earnest, and it's nothing flashy about it, but he's really welcoming. And as you know from the show, and when we've spoken with him, he's really personable and honest, and that comes across in the book. And I think that's something in a cookbook that people rely on, just like they would a favorite romance writer or science fiction writer. There's a certain sensibility that they will go to time and again, and I think this is the same with Jacques Pepin. Cookbooks. And his recipes work.
Yes, they do, and they're delicious.
Yeah.
Let's go to the phones, and Mark in Lake Pepin is up first. Mark, hi.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks.
Good. What would you like to talk about? What was your favorite book?
Well, I really loved a book of nonfiction that I read earlier this year. It was published by Grey Wolf Press, and it's called The Border by Kopka Kosobova. And she's a Bulgarian writer originally, though she lives in Scotland now. And she returned to Bulgaria to write about a series of trips that she took across the border between Bulgaria and Turkey. And she was both writing about the history of this region, but also writing about it as a place where there is so much activity because of the Syrian refugee crisis and people coming to Europe through this area. But she was also writing about it as what it was like during the Cold War, as a place where people from the East tried to cross into the West. And so the whole narrative of the book really spans a long period of time, and it talks about a region as having had a kind of very interesting and troubling relationship with sort of the movement of people across borders.
And our producer, Natalie Guyette, actually looked it up in the complete name so people can find it, is Border, A Journey to the Edge of Europe. And again, the author's name is Kapka Kasavova. And Mark Rotella, we'll turn to you, other Mark. You know, I think there is something to the edge of Europe. Bulgaria really is kind of on the edge of what people are usually familiar with or think of as Europe.
Right, exactly. I mean, it borders right there, Turkey and Greece. And so you've got three various, very different cultures coming in, you know, right at that one point. And it is true, this is a point of entry to a world that people don't really know about. And when a writer such as Kapka Kasavova is able to portray it, you know, is able to describe it in such a way, I mean, it's a really great, you know, it's a great experience. And Grey Wolf, and Mark, I'm happy to hear you reading Grey Wolf Press. They're a really strong literary imprint that's just coming out with some wonderful books.
Thanks for that call, Mark. And Rich on Facebook says, best book of painful diary entries, which are painful and hilarious at the same time. No surprise with who the author is. David Sedaris is Theft by Finding, Diaries 1977 to 2002. I have to say, I did not know that was out there, and I will be making a beeline to find that.
Yeah. And David Sedaris is just, I love that he could just go back and tap into diary entries in the 1970s and still come up with this really witty, nutty perspective.
Right. And painful and hilarious sums up pretty much all of what he's written, I would say. So
right, exactly.
That's great. And, you know, diaries obviously are a form of memoir. And Mark, one of your favorite memoirs of the year was chosen by Publishers Weekly was Ants Among Elephants by Sujatha Githa.
Mm-hmm, right.
And what's that memoir about?
So Sujatha grew up in India as an untouchable, which is so low in the caste system that it's not even a caste. And the book is really a history of her family, not so much her until the end. But what I really enjoyed, and this is when I mentioned immigration earlier on, she is now a train engineer for the New York City subway station, so she drives the trains. And this is a book about her family and about 20th century India. And she talks about class, gender, religion. And these are really, you know, a lot of, you know, hotly contested political battles here. And I just really enjoy this, and I enjoyed to know that she was a New York City subway engineer.
Yeah. As we start to wrap up a little bit, another memoir that I think got as much attention for what it meant for the author as for the memoir itself was You Don't Have to Say You Love Me by Sherman Alexie, which dealt a lot with his very difficult relationship with his mother, to the extent that talking about it day after day on a book tour, he actually had to cancel the rest of the appearances.
Yeah, exactly. And Sherman Alexie, he himself, his writing crosses so many genres, from children's to poetry, nonfiction, fiction. And yeah, this was a really, really brutally honest book to read, and I'm assuming to write. And talking about growing up on a reservation, and his relationship with his mother and also his father, but how the relationship with his mother lingered and really formed him for better and for worse.
Well, Mark, we have barely scratched the surface of 2017, and we haven't even looked forward to 2018. I'm wondering if maybe you'll come back and talk with us another time about what to look for in the new year.
I'd be thrilled to, anytime.
All right. Mark, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Mark Rotella is a senior editor at Publishers Weekly, where he's also the host of their PW radio show. He's an author and board member of the National Book Critics Circle and joined us to talk about the best books of 2017. When the temperatures drop like they have this week in Wisconsin, utility bills often go up, but hopefully yours won't be anywhere near the one that Mary Horomansky of Erie, Pennsylvania got. She recently opened a bill for $284,460,000,000 with a first, I guess, relatively modest payment due of $28,176. Horomansky said that at first she tried to make sense of it, like, were their Christmas decorations really using that much electricity? Happily, when her son checked with the power company, it turned out that the $284 was correct, but just dollars, not billions of dollars. Still more than the last month's bill, but definitely in the realm of the possible. If you're wondering what that original $284 billion could buy, the Washington Post says that you could own all of Netflix, buy 747 Boeing 747s with a little change to spare, or could erase the national debts of Venezuela, Nigeria, Peru, and Iceland combined. Or, you know, you could make a really nice year-end donation to WPR. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll find out why cheating yourself on sleep could mean a shorter life. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time.